This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 33 of What's It Like. My guest is Gary Muehldeer, who is in South Dakota.
Yes, Black Hills.
I love the people of South Dakota. They are so authentic. They would never make up a name like Gary Muehldeer.
Or Spearfish or Deadwood, right? I was actually born in Deadwood and raised in Spearfish. And went away for 30 years to L.A. and then came back in 94. And I've been here, working out of here ever since. Although I'm on the road 200 days a year. But I'm in South Dakota, all right.
When did you come up with the name Gary Muehldeer?
You know, it was in 1970, you know, one of those chemically altered states that I was in at the time. And I was traveling with a group called Bandana on Paramount Records. And I was the only guy old enough to drive the bus. I drive just like Wyoming and Utah and Arizona and Montana. And I would spot mule deer. We had a Checker cab limousine with a Chrysler engine in it. And it held 10 people. We had our instruments on top. And people would wake up in the middle of the night. I'd have the limousine stopped, and I'd be spotlighting mule deer out in the fields or along the side of the road. And a guy named Sherman Hayes, who was later became Waylon Jennings' bass player, who I heard left the group because Waylon couldn't get him down out of a tree one night. But that's another story. Anyway, Sherman Hayes started calling me mule deer, and it stuck. So I changed it legally in 1970.
People usually refer to you as a comedian singer, but you've been a musician from the early days, haven't you?
I've always been that's what I started out doing. I started out doing, I was digging graves with a partner for $50 a grave in the middle of the winter with a pick and shovel, and about to enter my fifth year as a freshman at Black Hills State Teachers College in Spearfish, South Dakota, and I decided I better do something different with my life. So I took a guitar lesson, and I practiced 15 Johnny Cash songs for 10 days, went to the Buffalo Bar in Deadwood, South Dakota, and got a job, and I've been working ever since. That was 1960.
What's the first song you learned?
Folsom Prison Blues. And then I did a backup. I learned the number one song in 1959 on the pop charts was a song called Mule Skinner Blues by the Fendermen, and it was a very hard song to sing and play, and I figured if I could master that one, it would make me a little unique, and I kind of got known for that for the next 4 or 5 years, that I could sing Mule Skinner Blues like the record.
So you grew up in South Dakota?
I grew up in South Dakota. I grew up in the grocery business, and then in the movie theater business, then supermarkets, and then ranching. So I had a pretty diverse background.
Yeah.
Having the movie theater in Spearfish in my early years and my early teens, I ran the concession stand, and it was a pretty good sized theater, and I would be out at the concession stand, and my mother sold tickets. She actually had a rear view mirror mounted in the ticket booth, so she could watch me at the check stand, concession stand, to make sure that I didn't eat too much candy, get away with any money. And also, she wouldn't let me watch a movie on my slow times or my breaks. She wouldn't let me open the curtain and watch the movies unless they were recommended in PTA magazine. So as years went by, I would see a movie on television later, and I remember I heard the movie, but I didn't see it. But of course, that was always good for your imagination. I grew up with radio, so, you know, I think that's why it was good for me with my comedy. I didn't grow up with no television until I was a senior in high school.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not that television didn't exist.
No, it was around. And it finally came in 1957 in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I just grew up with radio. You know, all my shows were on the radio. I loved Jack Benny. I loved Eve Arden. Those were my comedic influences. And then, of course, Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis. People like that were my musical influences, Buddy Holly.
So how did your parents impact your worldview?
My dad was a workaholic, and my mother always wanted to be a singer. And instead, she had children, and she kept me home a lot. She was pretty strict with us. And I started reading at a very young age. Actually, I had an uncle that was more influential on me I would say, than my parents, because he had made it all of a sudden. He made it. I had an uncle that left Missouri in the early 30s and went to what was called Mesopotamia at the time, which I believe now is Iraq, and worked on the first oil pipeline. And he drove a Caterpillar tractor. Uh-huh. And one day his Caterpillar started to sink in the sand, and he jumped free. And when they dug out the Caterpillar, they started to find the remnants and pieces of an ancient city.
Hmm.
So they routed the pipeline around that area and started doing an archaeological dig. And my uncle became kind of famous over there, for the guy that kind of discovered it was because of him. He became a figurehead guy for Shell Oil. So traveled around more in the, as a marketing person, made a lot of money, came back and took the whole family from Missouri and moved them to South Dakota.
Wow.
And he started a fruit and vegetable business here, fresh fruit and vegetable business, with trucks going in and out of Denver, Colorado, and hired all of his brothers to work for him. So my dad worked all the time, but my uncle would take me with him. We would drive around in his Cadillac in the Black Hills when I was 4 and 5 years old, and he would make me read billboards to him. At night, he would make me try to read the newspaper to him, and if I do that, he would take me to movies. So I became a reader at an early age, and I still do that today. It's still 3 or 4 newspapers a day. I always have 1 or 2 books going at all times, and don't really have enough time to either watch television or listen to music that much. I'm still just an addicted reader.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where my worldview came from. I really always knew everything that was going on all the time, and I'm kind of a news junkie too. So, yeah, indirectly, they influenced me by letting my uncle take me, I think, before school. By the time I got into preschool, I could read, and by the time I was in first grade, I was probably reading at the level of a 4th or 5th grader, which was pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I lost my father. I came back in 94 because I knew my father wasn't going to be around much longer. He had cancer that was only going to live for a couple of years, so he came back. I came back here to the Black Hills to be around him, and also my wife's parents were getting older. And once he left, my mom, who's going to be 93, she's just like me. She just reads everything, only watches PBS, does 2 crossword puzzles a day, and knows the words to every song written since 1920. I mean, she's amazing.
How'd you get into comedy?
I actually got into comedy because I wasn't a very good musician, Ken. The first night I was working in Deadwood, South Dakota, in the Buffalo Bar, in the middle of my first song, I missed a B7th chord. I really wasn't ready to go on stage yet. There were only about 8 people in the audience, but it was an obvious mistake. I quit playing and I quit singing, and this 5 or 6 people and the bartender in the place kind of looked up at me. And so I kind of acted like I did it on purpose. And I told a joke, and I got a laugh, went back, did some more music. Every time I would make a mistake, I would stop and tell a joke. It got to be kind of funny. I noticed I really liked the reaction I was getting from the laughter.
Mm-hmm.
So in between sets, I was hired to work on the weekend, Friday and Saturday. I was hired to work from 9 p.m. until 1 a.m. in the morning. 4 45-minute sets, 15 minutes off in between. In between sets, I went over and played and gambled on the pinball machines, which they had in all the bars at that time. By the end of the night, I had lost 12 of my $15 gambling in between shows. And as I was packing up my guitar and my microphone and my little amplifier after the show that night, there was a lady sitting at the bar in her 40s or 50s. And she asked me what I was going to do. And I said, probably get something to eat and go home. She said, why don't you come with me? So I took my guitar and my amplifier and my microphone, and I went outside and down the street of Main Street of Deadwood with her. And since 1876 until 1979, actually, brothels were legal in Deadwood, South Dakota. And she was the madam at one of the brothels. And she took me upstairs, and I sat in a little room, and I played my guitar, and I sang my Johnny Cash songs, and I made my mistakes, and I told my jokes. And it was an area reception area where the guys came out and met the girls. And there were miners from the Homestake Gold Mine, which was on 24-hour shifts. The Ellsworth Air Force Base was only 50 miles away. The oil fields of Wyoming were only about 40 miles away. And all the cowboys and sheep herders and ranchers. And then we had the 2 colleges. So the place was really hopping. Every Friday night and Saturday night, Deadwood, South Dakota was really something. So I did that until about 4 in the morning, I'm starting to get tired, and the madam came up and gave me a little black pill, and I took the pill, and it was something she gave her girls so that they would turn more tricks on weekends. It kept them up for 48 hours. So at noon the next day, I was still playing my guitar. You know, Gary, you can stop now. Now, the only reason I'm telling you this is that this is kind of what I got into the first night in the business. I got into to music, comedy, gambling, and pretty much drugs and prostitution all in the first night of show business. And the only reason I'm telling you about this whole story is that I'm a 20-year, I mean, I've been clean and sober now 25 years, but I was a 20-year cocaine guy. And that was the start of my drug thing was that night, I think, my first night in show business. And the only difference between that night and the Saturday night when I went back up to Deadwood is that before I did my show at the Buffalo Bar, I went up to her place and got another one of those pills because I hadn't been to bed yet. I played my Buffalo Bar, then went back to her place that night. So that was all starting a whole addiction thing and a whole thing in show business.
So a lot of your career was time spent with drugs.
Yes, it was. I had a career for a lot of years, Ken, that was totally motivated by self-destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Just made myself, I had to work every night. I got pretty good because I had to work every night just to stay up with my habits, just to keep even, you know. And no one really knew. I was very good at hiding it because I was a reader. So everything I read about drug addicts, I made sure I didn't do so people weren't suspicious. Plus, you know, you become very crafty after a while, and the less you have people worry about you, that means the more bad things you can do to yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was very good at that, unfortunately.
Drugs in showbiz is not uncommon. So did you hang out with other people who had similar problems?
Yes, I did. And, well, yeah, you gravitate toward people like that. You gravitate toward all the people that, you know, that do that kind of thing. You want to be around them, they want to be around you. Pretty soon, that's all your friends are friends, people that are doing the same kind of thing you're doing. I also was out opening for a lot of acts on the road, and I would gravitate toward the wild guys more than anyone else. I would gravitate toward the guys that were either big drinkers or that did drugs, and at the time, anyway, and they were comfortable with me opening for them and hanging out with them after the show. So it was kind of an endless cycle, yeah.
You spent a long time with Johnny Mathis, didn't you?
Yes, now, Johnny and I, that's been all sober days. I've been with Johnny since 1994.
Oh.
I got sober in 1987, but yes, I've been with part of the Johnny Mathis show since 94, which is a great job. I go on in the middle of the show and do 30 minutes. He comes out, does 35, he brings me out for 30. There's a 20-minute intermission, and he comes back. I come out and do a bow at the end with him, and that's it, and it's wonderful. And it's the greatest audiences in the world because I love older audiences. And John has loyal fans from the 50s all the way up. And I say this, it sounds like a joke, but they can't be old enough for me anymore, Ken.
Well, we are getting up there, you know.
Very thankful for me because most people in their 70s and 80s now are terrified of what they see for comedy today.
Mm.
They're scared to death what they see on TV, whatever it is, or films, whatever. And with me, I'm pretty much G-rated, and I've never worked any way any different. Plus, they all love the music of Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
So it's great for me. They're very comfortable with me. I'll have people come up to me and say, you know, we were so relieved. And also people will come up and say, you know, I love the comment that they say, you know, I never laugh at comedians, but I laughed at you. Now, I don't know if that's a comment, if that's what that is, but I just take it and go, great. But I get a lot of satisfaction from what I do. I'll have people come up to me all the time and say, you know, a guy and his sisters or his mom will come up and say, we haven't laughed since Dad died.
Mm.
I mean, things like that. And you brought us all together, or I'll be on with parents. And parents will come up to me on a ship and say, this is the first time we've seen our kids laugh. And the kids, it's the first time they've laughed at their parents. Generally, the kids hate what their parents think is funny, and the parents hate what the kids think is funny today. So some way I bridge that gap without, you know, consciously doing it. And that's satisfying to me.
Do you use a lot of your classic gags?
I still have a lot of classic things. I have a lot of classic things, but I like to tell stories. A lot of it at this point in my life now, Ken, is timing. Timing is the biggest thing with my act, and that's what I've pretty much accomplished over the years. Is my timing is pretty darn good. I mean, honest to God, in 19 when I had a partner, we were the Mule Deer and Moondog Medicine Show from 70 to 76. We can talk about that a little bit if you want later, but we were working at a Playboy Club in Chicago, and Jack Benny and his manager were in the audience. And at the end of the show, Jack Benny had me come over, and I'll never forget this. It was just before his 82nd or 83rd birthday, I think. He put his hand on my shoulder, and he said to me, "Young man, you have the potential of my timing." I never forgot that. And that was when I'd only been doing, you know, been in the business only about 10 or 11 years. So that was pretty cool. That was great.
You often have a very deadpan expression as you do your jokes.
Which I did for years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did a lot of, I was pretty much known for the deadpan. I was known as a deadpan comedian for a lot of years, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I did props.
Right.
I was also a big prop guy.
That's true. You used to shoot arrows with your guitar.
Shoot arrows? I still do that. I still tape a rubber chicken to a microphone, put a blindfold on it, stick a cigarette in its mouth, walk off 30 feet, put my leg up on a chair, prop up my guitar using it as a bow, and I shoot a rubber-tipped arrow off of my E string and shoot the cigarette out of his mouth.
How did you come up with that bit?
Probably boredom on stage. In 1970, Mule Deer and Moondog, when we were partners, we came up with it. He held the chicken out one night, and I just turned around and shot an arrow off my guitar and sort of morphed into something else, and now it's one of the things that I'm known for.
That's true.
They have to see the chicken. They all want to see the chicken. Two things that I did a lot of in the 70s was that, and also putting a typewriter on my shoulder and tapping the keys and doing the news, making the sound of a newsroom, of a teletype machine.
Yes.
And I did that until up to a few years ago, and no one knew what a teletype machine was anymore. But up until that time, to this day, I will walk through an airport and somebody will catch my eye, an older person, and they will point to their shoulder and tap on it. Remember that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, those bits were great. To be known for props, they also was also a bane in my career, because all of the big shows hated props and they didn't like comedians that had played instruments. And I had a terrible time, like with The Tonight Show, Ken. The only time they called Deary Mule Deer is when someone canceled.
Uh-huh.
They like my props, and they didn't like my guitar. Mm-hmm. But I always did a good job.
Yeah.
I was the guy they could call, and I could be out there in 2 hours and do a show for them. And they knew it would be fantastic, but they would never sit down on the panel, let me talk. They would never let me sit on the panel. And they would never let me be on with Johnny Carson, only with guests, because of my props. Yeah. And my guitar.
What's the best thing about your job?
Best thing about my job, I think the greatest thing about it is that I still make people laugh the healthy way. And I talk about this occasionally in my show, whatever. But when I get through, I talk about it, and they've laughed for an hour with healthy laughter. All my laughter is above the belt. You see a lot of comedy now in the last, for years and years now, where it's shock or it's reaction. It's not true belly laughs. They always said laughter was the best medicine. And it is if it comes from the right place.
Yeah.
You see somebody like Ellen DeGeneres and Rita Rudner doing as good as they can do with their audiences, and the audience sound is at that peak. It is all very healthy laughter. As opposed to Sarah Silverman and Lisa Lampanelli doing as well as they can do with their audience at the same volume, it comes from a different place. It's a different sound. But then I don't put them down for being as successful as whatever they're doing a hell of a lot better than Gary Mulder did as far as becoming successful. But there is a big difference in the sound of the two.
Well, your comedy is always very clever.
I try to be, hopefully that it is, yes. I always wanted it to be that way, you know? And I also have, whether this is good or bad, I've written things that Steve Martin and I wrote together back in the 60s that still works as well today as it did 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
40 years ago. I mean, honest to God, I have some things now that I wrote 40 years ago that are working now as well as they ever have. And, you know, that, I'm glad I have some timeless pieces. I really am.
You and Steve used to hang out, didn't you?
Yes, Steve Martin and I were, we were both working at a club called Ledbetter's in West L.A. I was in Denver, Colorado, going nowhere after the first year I left the Black Hills. And I'd worked every bar there was to work. I was even trying to supplement my income as being a tile and rug salesman at Sears. I hadn't sold one thing. It was all a commissions job. I had no money, nothing. And a guy, a folk singer from Denver, Colorado, said to me, "Can you play the bass?" And I lied and I said, "Yes." Because I'm going out to join the Greenwood County Singers in Los Angeles. And they have a hit called The New Frankie and Johnny Song. And they're looking for a bass player and a 12-string guitar player, which he was. So I had a 53 Buick with no heater and one window missing. I left it sitting with the keys in it in the parking lot at Griff's Hamburgers. Got into the car with him with a sack of clothes and my guitar, and we headed for L.A. We got into L.A. 2 days later. We went down to the Greenwood County Singers' office. We went in. They were going to have a rehearsal immediately. They stuck a stand-up bass in my hand, counted off the first song, and I just stood there frozen. And what if, what's, Bob, the guy wrote out, what's wrong? And I said, "I don't know how to tell you guys this, but I lied. I can't play bass, but I'm really funny." This was Carson Parks and Van Dyke Parks. If you look up Van Dyke Parks, you'll see one of the greatest composers, arrangers of all, and producers of all time is Van Dyke Parks, who they just stared at me. And so they put me out on the street waiting for the rehearsal to be over. And after the rehearsal was over, the guy that gave me the ride out took me up to a club called Ledbetter's, which was built by the Christy Minstrels and Randy Sparks, the owner of the Christy Minstrels.
Oh, yeah.
He built the club. And Bob knew the cook there. So he took me up and said, "You can just stay on his floor tonight. I'm through with you. When the shows are over tonight, you go home with him." So I went in, and here's what the club was like. Randy Sparks and the Back Porch Majority, a farm team of the Christy Minstrels, were the act in the club. John Denver was still John Duchendorf. He was the MC. Steve Martin was the resident comedian. There were acts like the Carpenters, who, like, Karen was only 12 at the time, and her and her brother had to sit out in the car with their mother in the alley because beer was sold. It was Mike Settle in the first edition. Kenny Rogers was just the bass player in the group. Mike Nesmith had a group there. He hadn't even been in the Monkees yet. Literally, this is what the place was like. I got in. I stayed with a guy that night, went down the next night at the club with him, and got it. And the manager gave me a job checking IDs on the door. And he said, "Also, Michael Martin Murphy is leaving the New Society and RCA Victor Records. We're holding auditions tonight. Sign up people that want to audition." So what I did, Ken, is just when they came up to the door, I turned everybody away except for two acts. I told them it was full and they'd already filled the position. All there was there, I had to go up against an accordion player and a girl folk duo that I knew he wasn't looking for. So then I went up and got the audition and got the job. And that's how I got into the business in Los Angeles. I don't know how we started on this story, but...
You won fair and square.
Yes, I did. I won it fair and square. That's right. So Steve and I became friends through that. Steve had a magic act at the time that never worked, and he played the banjo. I played guitar. We tried to be an act for a while. That didn't work out. But we had a house together, him and I, and a great singer-songwriter, Michael Johnson, who has a song, Bluer Than Blue, Let's Spend the Night Together. He's had a couple of top 40 hits and is one of the funniest people I know. By the way, musicians have always been funnier to me than comedians.
Yes.
Everybody that I know, all the musicians I hung with, they're like Roger Miller, whatever, all the guys, whether it's Steve Martin, Michael Johnson, musicians to me have always been funnier. The funniest person I know that I've ever known has been Vince Gill. Vince Gill is the funniest person I know, and believe me, I know all the comedians, I know them all.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, aside being one of the most talented people, singer, songwriter, guitar player, you know, producer. So, yeah, the funniest guys have always been musicians. I would much rather travel in a busload of musicians than a busload of comedians.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than being around a bunch of comedians trying to top each other all night.
What has surprised you about your job?
Oh, I think what surprised me about my job is, number one, that I've lasted this long.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, that I still love my job at this age. That has really surprised me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really thankful that the people still like what I do, and that I still have a lot of respect for my peers. It's great. And I think that surprised me more than anything. It also has surprised me is that when I got out of rehab and I took up golf, I exchanged Coke for golf. I took another four-letter word. And it's my life. And I started going to celebrity events and doing my act and learning to play golf and got to meet all my heroes.
Ah.
It's a surprise in the world to be the only Yankee fan in the Black Hills of South Dakota in the 40s and 50s. Literally, I was the only guy in this area that's a Yankee fan. And then going to events and becoming friends with Joe DiMaggio and Yogi Berra and Whitey Ford and Moose Gowron and guys like that. I mean, Hank Bauer. To me, that was, I mean, and then Johnny Unitas and all these people that you know, the older guys that I came up with, and I got to meet all these guys and play golf with them and hang out. And that was a huge surprise to me, and all the great actors and TV movie guys, all the great old musicians that ended up becoming, you know, going to these events.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's been terrific. And I've made some incredible friends out of them, you know.
Yeah.
My wife and I both have. That's a big surprise to me. That was a huge one to me.
We'll have more with Gary Mielder right after I remind you of the importance of health. CFIDS, chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome, is a complex disorder that impacts many parts of the body. It's not just getting tired, it's having your life devastated. My daughter went to Nicaragua after her sophomore year at Harvard. She volunteered at an orphanage and came home with a flu-like condition and went from being very active to bedridden. My daughter's been sick for 11 years, and there's no cure, so please help. Go to CFIDS.org, and click on Donate, CFIDS.org. Thanks. So, Gary, I think of fame as being like different levels or circles.
Right.
What level of fame are you at?
I am Gary Mielder, somewhat famous. Time to think about this. In fact, I'm working on a documentary / live performance show with Connecticut Public Television. And Eric Jones, the director, unfortunately, was in Westfield in Springfield, Massachusetts, when the horrible tornadoes came through last week. So right now, some of our projects have been put on hold. However, Connecticut Public Television, at the end of this month, on the 30th, just Connecticut alone is going to show the performance part of my show. I did it at the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. But I would hate to be famous today. I couldn't handle that. There is no way. Celebrity today is so much different than it was, you know, that I've watched it come up in the last 50 years. With the paparazzi, with the magazines, with the constant barrage of stuff, it's just I'm glad I'm where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
Really glad that I'm where I'm at. I'm feel very fortunate to be right here, to still do the great theaters, to still work with a lot of the great, some of the legends, and I'm just happy to do it. I mean, it's hard work. Literally being on the road 200 days a year and flying in and out of blizzards all the time in the Black Hills of South Dakota. But I've managed to do it and work great places. I mean, in the last couple of years, working everywhere from Carnegie Hall to Wolf Trap to, you know, everywhere. It's wonderful.
But you're a working musician comedian.
Yes, I am.
Can you go into, I mean, if you were with Johnny Mathis, he probably can't go anywhere.
No, he can't go anywhere.
But can you go without being recognized?
I can go all kinds of places without being recognized. Yes, I can.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really great is that I'm actually accepted by a lot of great musicians, which are terrific. I mean, I was on the road last year. The Zac Brown Band took me out for a few dates last August. And Vince Gill took me out the whole month of October with him.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. Then I'm with Johnny Mathis for the whole year. So, I mean, literally, that's three different audiences completely.
Yes,
you know?
Quite different.
And me being able to go out and do that and to work with all kinds of audiences and musicians, to me, is as good as it gets, you know, and music with them and to do my comedy and the whole thing. So, you know, I work everywhere from, I've been everywhere from Royal Albert Hall to the Grand Ole Opry, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it really is.
Everyone has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I learn something new on the guitar.
Hmm.
I find something that I'm excited about, and I make myself go out and do it for the first time in front of an audience. I mean, literally without, I mean, I'll work on it for a week, like I did a couple of weeks ago in Massachusetts, and then went out for a big college fundraiser. And instead of ending what I usually end with, just me and my guitar, I did a Merle Haggard song that's 35 years old, My Way. And that motivated me. If I can go out there and do that and pull it off and make it look like I've been doing that song for 30 years, that gives me motivation.
Mm-hmm. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Fly fish and, weirdly enough, read about the Civil War. How weird is that?
Mm. Wow, that's very specific.
I'm a Civil War buff. I mean, that's my thing. In fact, in October, I'm going to Gettysburg, and there's a guy named Ed Bars, who is one of the foremost Civil War guides ever. I think he's been guiding for 60-some years Civil War battlefields, and he's taking out 25 or 30 of us. We're going out. And for 2 days, we're going to walk the battlefield of just what happened on the second day of Gettysburg. Little Round Top, Big Round Top, the wheat field, Devil's Den, the orchard, you know, all of that stuff. I'm looking forward to that. I read about the Civil War all the time, which is strange because I think I'm as healthy as I am and my wife are as healthy as we are because people have no idea how old we are because we don't look our age at all. And I think one of the reasons we've taken violence out of our lives.
Mm.
Watch violent films. I don't watch violent TV. I don't read violent books anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say that because I do read the Civil War. I read about 50 years ago. Yes, horribly violent. As violent as this country's ever seen. But I just don't put up with it. I don't put up with people who do a lot of profanity. We dislike that. We just try to keep lead a more gentler life. And you know what? If you do that, you're just a lot better inside and outside. Honest to God, if people would only realize that. Ken, I can go. I live in airports, and I swear to you, I'll stop in to buy my newspapers, and I'll look at the top New York Times top 50 bestsellers, paperbacks on the wall. I guarantee you 48 out of 50 of them are murder books. And people are just unconsciously reading this stuff if they're not sitting mindlessly thumbing through a stack of celebrity magazines in first class. They're just mindlessly reading this stuff. And they don't think anything of it. And to them, it's no different than having their kids watch anything violent on television or taking a bunch of kids and their friends to a PG-13 or an R-rated film. Boy, I get really when I...
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
I think my staying sober was one.
Mm-hmm.
Staying sober was a big one.
How did you decide to become sober?
Well, it almost killed me. I think I was just getting ready to. It was really turning on me a lot. My then to be wife and I were out in Los Angeles. She was working with my manager. She was seeing me go down really fast, and I think actually I'd heard that I used to go to bed every 3 days. I used to go to bed. I think every 3 days I would sleep for a night. And I think I heard that Keith Richards did it for 2 nights or a week or something. And I think that must have been I tried it. Anyway, I ended up in intensive care. I went into a rehab, came out, had a slip 10 days later, and then got scared again health-wise, and that did it for me. That has to be one of the biggest ones,
mm-hmm.
I think. And then getting past that,
yeah.
You know. But it makes you think with me, I almost thought I was dying before I quit. It's too bad it had to come to that.
Yeah. And you've been clean and sober for how long now?
I'm clean and sober now since 1987.
Hmm.
It's been great.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say? What's your best advice?
I'll tell you what I did on my commencement address. My commencement address, I was asked to come to the college to speak at commencement, and they didn't realize that I was a 7-year freshman. So I remember getting up and saying to them, the first thing I said to them was that this is actually the first time I've been on campus when I wasn't on probation. They'd already given me an honorary degree, an honorary plaque, you know, the whole thing. And what I would say at commencement, gosh, it's kind of hard for me to say because of the way I was with school. I just I think everything that I told you about just before this, we talked about to live your life right now, is to start getting away. If you can start to separate yourself from the violence and the bad things and all the stuff like we do here, and I think inside and out, it really starts to make a difference in your life. I think it's more important now than ever to pull away from the dark side, because we are sucking the drain so fast, it's frightening. And I think that would be the main thing.
Would you encourage someone to become a musician?
I would, I'll tell you at this point, I would encourage them to become a musician, but not try to be famous or a celebrity. People want to be a famous or a celebrity right away, but if you earn it, yes, I think so. But not just be selfish about it and just do that and nothing else with your life. And then, you know, expect that this is what it's going to be, because that's not the way it is. You got to have some experience and you got to have some heart. That's it. Yeah.
Who is the most famous person that you've met?
The most famous person that I've ever met. I'm trying to think. There's been some people when you think about Joe DiMaggio at one time in his life, there was no one more famous than Joe DiMaggio was at the time. And I became friends with Joe. Joe liked my comedy. Joe was a real gentleman. There was an event I went to every year that I always made sure we had dinner together the first night of the event. I rode around in a with him. He was only chipping and putting at that time in his life. But someone like that comes to mind. Jimmy Carter came in one night after I did a show with Crystal Gayle in the Las Vegas Hilton. I was backstage and a couple of guys came in suits and sunglasses and said, Jimmy Carter would like to come in and talk to you. Talking to Jimmy Carter while his wife talked with Crystal Gayle at the time. And I always had so much respect for Jimmy Carter. So someone like that was a pretty thrilling thing. I'm sitting here right now getting cues from my wife who just walked in from the chiropractor because my mind is sieve-like at this time and reminding me of some of the people. I mean, I've met so many. Being able to work with people and then ending up being, you know, at the time, you know, when Nita and I ended up getting to be friends with Jerry Orbach and his wife. I mean, when Jerry Orbach, who probably one of the greatest people on Broadway ever, and then to have a show like, you know, like to have a show like Law and Order, and to be able to hang out with people like him. And then, of course, I'm doing shows with people like Glenn Campbell, some of the greatest people ever, and the Smothers Brothers, who are always my heroes. And, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a lot of them. It's pretty much we've met an awful lot of people. I've worked with everyone from Merle Haggard we've got to think about Merle Haggard and Roger Miller and Gordon Lightfoot, who was the biggest at one time when I was out on the road with him, and all these different people.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm with an icon. I'm with Johnny Mathis all the time. A lot of great people come back to see him. There are so many. You know, I never thought I'd get to be friends with some of here's a guy I really respect in the business, and Nita and I both do, is Peter Marshall, who, although he became known, he's known mainly for being the host of Hollywood Squares. Here's a guy besides Broadway and who was back doing films in the early years and was in Las Vegas with a partner for years and years and is still out there singing with a big band, you know, and hosting big band specials on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
People like that. I never thought I would ever meet movie people like Dale Robertson and people like that at golf tournaments, you know, guys that I saw in Westerns coming up.
Yeah.
People like that.
I never thought I'd get to meet Gary Muledeer.
That's very nice.
I want to thank Gary Muledeer for joining me. Thanks, Gary. I really appreciate it.
Hey, we had a great time, huh?
We did.
All right.